Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Welcome back to the show, Rick.
Indeed, a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for inviting me on.
Rick, commercial real estate, empty office space, a major concern right now, but there may be even more of a reason to be concerned about this decline in traffic in and out of cities to occupy these towers.
Yeah, this is something you and I have been talking about for a while. And I let me apologize in advance because some of the ideas that I have been tweaked a little bit by my favorite blogger, Charles Hugh Smith. He was writing on the theme of the doom spiral of the great cities. And some of those ideas have sort of sat with me. So there may be a little bit of overlap, but I don't mean to plagiarize Charles. But he has added some interesting ideas. You know, the doom spiral in the context of what we've discussed. Looking, let's say, at New York City, I had pictured New York City as being it's dying above ground, at ground, and below ground for revenue problems at each level. The above ground was it got fleshed out in an interesting way I'm trying to remember whether it was maybe Jim Rickards who wrote about it. Oh no, I'm sorry. It was Kunstler, who writes brilliantly about any number of subjects. But he's talking about the energy problem, and this is something common to Charles's thinking too. That when energy is in an infinite abundance, you don't think twice about taking an elevator from the 77th floor of your New York office tower, going down to ground level and getting a hot dog. But the energy input just to get you down to the ground and back up to your office it's only possible to do that sort of thing when you have energy in infinite supply. So Kunstler has been a little bit ahead of the peak energy theme, but I think neither he nor Charles is going to be wrong in the long run that we'll have to at some point stop treating energy as being infinitely abundant. All right. So in a case in New York, though, the office towers, and this is the same thing. I would say it's going to hold true for San Francisco, but it's already played out in spades there with the offices are vacant. And the only way that you can build an enormity like the Salesforce.com building, which is spectacular, is if you build it with bogus money. You know, you basically cash out shares. The shares of Salesforce were inflated to an extent that they could actually say, well, you know, if we spend $1.5 billion putting up a huge skyscraper, it's just a few shares of stock, which it was. I mean, these companies have essentially financial asset inflation on their own books. They carry a quote-unquote surplus in the tens of billions of dollars. So when Salesforce puts up this, I don't know what the cost of the building would be, but it's an amazing building. They've got a fabulous atrium, I think, on the sixth or seventh floor, and it's pretty much empty. And all the big owners are really trying to lease space now. And in San Francisco, it's a losing battle because you've got a 40% or higher vacancy rate. So many of these big office buildings are see-throughs. And it's realistic at this point to say it's never coming back. You know, you're not going to get, not only are you not going to get people to, from the, suburbs to come back into the city to work in the office towers, but those people themselves have dispersed in ways that, that has kind of atomized what used to be called Silicon Valley. You know, tech is all over the place. It could be in Pittsburgh, which, is a rarity. It's having a resurgence because they had a lot of really good housing, and they had, of course, the robotics department at Carnegie Mellon and some other things. But anyway, all these tech workers, they're never coming back to the Salesforce building because they can work from anywhere. And that's a big problem with the knowledge industry in general. The knowledge industry doesn't have to be in a place, to be productive. In fact, it's less than productive if it's occupying office space, or it's less productive. So in New York City, the office towers are dying. And of course, that means that all the ground level amenities, such as the, hot dog carts, but also Carnegie Hall, you know, they're the same thing. They're really, things where discretionary income goes. And of course, the discretionary income is no longer coming into the city. Habits are changing, and all the concert halls will die, and the theaters will die. And of course, below ground, you have that subway system, and corresponding to the bus system and taxis at ground level, which have fixed costs that don't decrease as fewer people start coming in. The fixed costs are all going to be there. And that, in certainly in a way that Charles has described it, is what has doomed the cities, that they're essentially hooked to these enormous fixed costs, but with the user base being just diminishing over time. So the cities have the option, you know, do we raise taxes, do we cut services? And it's probably going to come in both ways, which is going to drive out the 10% that's still rich enough to be able to afford the taxes and even have a money left over for concerts. But they're going to desert the big cities as well. So the big cities are dying. And it's when you kind of juxtapose that inevitability against this maybe bull rally we're having in the stock market, the rally seems that much more ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is driving that rally? It seems anybody who puts AI onto the name of their company now is getting some kind of investment, whether they deserve to or not. Kind of reminiscent of the .com thing before the 2000 bust, where you just had to put .com on it.
Well, I'm not quite buying that. Yeah. I think that the trend, the whole AI thing, was so stupid to begin with that even the village idiots appreciated that AI was nothing. You know, from my perspective, AI is what has given us auto spell, you know, auto correct, and it's given us so many things. You can't even check out of a grocery store right now without having someone help you with their little AI, scanner. So, and of course, one of the big AI projects, which was driverless cars, that's already gone down in flames. So I think that the failures of AI are so gigantic that even the idiots aren't fooled really into thinking that's where the big investment money's going. And in the same way, the driverless cars not only caught the imagination of all the droolers, it really attracted a lot of hubris in the news media. I think the same thing's happening in AI, you know, but this time the recognition cycle, where the proletarian mind gets the idea this AI is just a big con job, it is. And, I think it's great to the extent that it's going to put virtually every lawyer out of business because AI can do what any lawyer can do, but better. Even as I mentioned to you, in arguing a case in court, it's got chapter and verse, the whole law library, in its tiny little circuitized brain. So AI has already flopped, And we're going to have to wait for another 10 or 20 years before it does anything interesting besides, you know, beat some of your better chess players. But for the time being, I think it's just kind of stalled at the threshold of its own hubris. It's a giant wall. And I think there's no shortage of high-tech wizards out there who are saying, you know, some of the futurists who are saying, yeah, you know, AI got quite a bit ahead of itself. But as an investment theme, I think it died with the introduction of the $3,500 goggles by Apple a few weeks ago. You know, they still don't get it. You know, Google tried with Google Glass, and it was such a failure because everybody realized when you wear a Google Glass, which gives you all kinds of data in your eyeglass frame, that you look like a nerd. And a similar problem, but unrecognized at the time that Apple made a big deal of its introduction of the goggles, is that it sort of walls you out of the real world. It's like your own little nerd space there, and that's just not the way things are going to happen. Eventually they will. You know, eventually, yeah, guys are going to be able to seduce anybody they want with four of their five senses active in some virtual reality scenario. But for the time being, you know, the AI, as it contributes to our entertainment with these goggles, is it's dead, and Apple killed it.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, is there any hope that these empty office spaces could be rediverted into something else? I saw a documentary where a business person in India is converting empty office space into homes. He has pods, kind of like prefab cabins that they install when they're making cruise ships. And you can put these cabin-like structures within the office space, so you have your little home in there, and then you connect it to the utilities that were set up for the office. And I could see where maybe two-thirds of a building residential, one-third office, and then commute time for you. Or do people want to live that close to the office because the boss could just call you in to do more overtime?
I don't think there's even one-tenth of 1% chance of that happening. In the first place, there's too much of that space, and you know, you got to figure out, well, where do we begin? Do we start converting all the movie chains into residential, or all the Macy's that are going to be empty space? Mm-hmm. There's so much empty commercial space that's not even office space. And there, at least if you've got big boxes, they'll convert more readily than a skyscraper. The skyscraper has the energy problem that I was just talking about. You know, if you're up on the 77th floor, you got to figure out if everybody's going to be living there. It's an entirely different usage from an energy standpoint. You're going to have people cooking and bringing their groceries up in the elevators and all. So no, the towers, the office towers, cannot be repurposed for residential. It's not even remotely feasible. Even again, with the single level big box stores, the conversion is very difficult, and there's many too many spaces for that to happen. It's like, where do we begin? I'm not a big believer in that.
Yes, and shopping malls, they were dying before the pandemic. How are they doing now?
Well, they're doing worse and worse and worse and worse, and I'm not quite sure how any of the REITs that got involved in financing are surviving. Of course, a lot of those REITs, they exist really to buy the marked-down malls, to essentially take a Class A mall or whatever, you know, malls that were generating quite a bit of revenue per square foot, and essentially acquiring them at a new price that made them more feasible to operate. But, you know, for every big box, you shut down, for every Nordstrom's or Macy's that goes out of business, you can't even begin to fill that with smaller vendors, because in the first place, the smaller vendors are dying. I mean, it's so hard to compete against Amazon to begin with. And so what do you fill those big stores with? Certainly not commercial space. And there's only so much need for farmers, you know, farmers markets and things like that. So there's such a huge glut of commercial space right now that however you want to repurpose it, there's just too much of it, really. So we have huge markdowns to come in real estate. And for all the yo-yos who talk about inflation being the theme of the future, you know, if you take just the real estate aspect of deflation, essentially we're talking about writing off our biggest cities. That's so hugely deflationary. And it's not even the biggest number. You know, the biggest number that we're going to write down is the leveraging out of financial assets, not physical assets like malls and skyscrapers and things, but financial assets that are essentially built with hot gas. So that's a much bigger write down. You're talking about in the quadrillions of dollars. You know, if you aggregate all the value of real estate, even commercial real estate, you're only talking about piddling numbers in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. So, but the financial juggernaut that's going to deflate is much bigger. So that's why I keep insisting that the end game is really deflation. There's no possibility at all of coming to an inflationary end.
Any thought about turning these towers into vertical farms? Would that be possible?
Not even remotely. Not even, you know, I gave you 1/10 of 1/100 of a percent before, but I don't think the farm concept even has that much of a chance, really. And again, they're the energy inputs. Even if you should be luck into a ground floor single story space where you can do hydroponic farming of marijuana, the costs are enormous just to do it at the ground level, you know, for the energy inputs, for the lighting and water as a resource. And you can barely make money. Well, the marijuana producers are making money, to be sure, but that's the wrong usage, really, to take an office tower.
Maybe we'll have to legalize cocaine and grow it indoors.
Well, that solution, we know, is not beyond the government. You know, if they're really strapped, then yes, by all means, we'll have legalized cocaine or worse. And just think of the revenues and all the kids that could put through college.
Yeah. Of course, the kids won't be worried about college because they're on cocaine. Although, all the people who want drugs now are getting it. And I think in Canada, the federal government was wise to, you know, legalize marijuana and tax it because that was the biggest moneymaker for organized crime. But because all the other drugs are still illegal and make a lot of money, we still have all the gangsters shooting people left, right, and center everywhere.
It's amazing, really, how big drugs have always been in the economy. You know, it's there's so much activity now, and I'm reading a book right now. It's a story about how the Aristotle Onassis, Jackie Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy triangle. And there's pretty good evidence there that Bobby Kennedy was assassinated on the money paid by Onassis to a guy who went out and hired an assassin. But when Onassis's shipping business was enormous, but even he got his start pushing drugs. You know, you almost get to thinking that behind every great fortune, there was a drug business somewhere along the way that got things started. It's really just it's seed money for everything else.
Yeah. Well, in the U.S. during Prohibition, you've never had higher per capita consumption of alcohol, and it was officially illegal.
Yeah, also a great business. You know, if you're talking about counter-cyclical, that's a good way to go. Although, you know, the beverage business is so atomized now that it's hard to make a good bet on booze. There's so many players.
Well, Pepsi bought SodaStream, where you make your own pop and soda, for $3 billion. So not a bad startup there for the fellows that did that.
I'm not sure what happened with SodaStream. You know, it could be, you know, when great ideas get bought up by the big companies tend to crap them up like they do everything else. You know, Disney would be a good example. They bought Pixar. Pixar was fabulous when it was new. They were really innovative and very successful. And now Disney has turned them into garbage. So the original SodaStream was a pretty good machine. But I know I bought someone as a gift, a second or third generation SodaStream, and it doesn't work. I mean, it's aggravating to use. It's really an annoyance. And so maybe that was Pepsi's influence trying to bring the price down with an inferior product.
Well, the machines still cost $120, but the parts are plastic and they break if you use it a lot.
Well, my original, it's almost like a 56 Chevy, you know, the plastic bottles that they say replace these every 6 months or whatever. Well, I've had mine for 5-6 years and they're just fine and it works really well. So, by the way, I just found a toaster. It turns out that when you make toast that doesn't turn out right, it's like half cooked on one side and half and black on the other. Well, it has to do with the number of coils that are in the toaster and how closely spaced they are. And I discovered that a toaster that I paid up for, you look at it closely and it's got the wires are spaced very tightly together, so you get great toasting. But I'm not quite sure where you really have to look around to find them anymore.
Yeah, to find stuff that's going to last more than 6 months.
Well, what are the things that you're using that have that quality that just seem to last?
Now, taking a look at the stock market, how long is this rally going to last? Because people keep saying, well, if we didn't get a big shakeout in the spring like has happened in the last few years, then are we going to be looking at what I call a classic fall on the stock market when you hit September, October, November?
Well, I had a subscriber suggest that because we've got so many of these three-day holidays interrupting the markets, that it's sort of changed the old the old idea that you go away in May, because nothing happens in the market between May and October. So my own thinking is that if that's disrupted, it's only for this year, because we're in a process of making a multi-generational top. And I try to keep as disconnected from the real world as I can when I forecast the stock market. And even though in my heart of heart and brain of brains, I'm extremely bearish. You know, we're talking about the doom of American cities and a massive and epic debt deflation and all that. But I have to put all that aside, really, and just look at the charts and recognize the fact that the market is a psychotic beast. And it doesn't really, you can't talk about, well, how much higher do you think it's going to go on a basis of some logic, some empirical evidence or calculation that you can do. It doesn't really, the market's not really related to the fundamentals, I guess you could say. It's just a creature of mass psychosis, and it has its moods. So, you know, the last couple quarters, it's been in a bullish mood that was completely oblivious to really mediocre earnings reports, dismal earning reports. It just kind of shrugged them off over the last two quarters. So I try to simplify everything as much as I can. And in this case, I look at just one stock, Chipotle. And Chipotle, I think, has a lot higher to go. It's it's currently trading just above 2,000, but I think it's going to 2,700. So if it's going to do that, then this bull market has a long way to go, and we could even see new all-time highs. But because I deeply distrust that at the logical level, I'm going to be watching very closely for signs of a change. You know, in the case of Chipotle, Chipotle is a hoax like every other stock. You know, most of the upside has taken place with no money or shares changing hands. You know, you had a gap back on in April where the stock closed one day at, 1,700 and something, and the very next day it was trading up as high as, 2,050 or so. So no money, or it didn't take any money or stock changing hands to cause that to happen. It was just like instant wealth. I use that word wealth in quotes. So since then, Chipotle has skittered sideways. It's months and months of sideways, as if to demonstrate the point, hey, you guys, we can hold this stock aloft effortlessly for more or less indefinitely. But when I say more or less, I mean that literally. You know, they've held it up there as though to sort of thumb their noses. Anybody who thinks that this market can't go a lot higher. But eventually the sideways gets to be so extended, they obviously can't take it higher, or it's not the right time to take it higher to make another leap. But it could come down really hard. And if that happens, I would rethink my scenario that maybe the stock market's going on to new record highs. But it's really just a few stocks that I look at: Apple, Chipotle, and Microsoft. And in technical terms, each of them has done something that suggests that higher prices, and maybe even significantly higher prices, are coming.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping an eye on right now?
our victory patch, I guess. I mean, I'm always. I think I can never quite get away from the idea that Charles Hugh Smith, one of the great bloggers, he's out there living not the dream, he's living the reality, which is his own Plan C, meaning have a backyard that's capable of producing, yeah, growing all the things that you need to eat and survive. So I think that in our personal lives, we really have to cultivate the kind of resourcefulness that might come in handy if everything we can buy so easily now through Amazon is no longer readily available. So part of that includes being self-sufficient in food, if not necessarily energy, but just don't believe all the hubris about bull market and this bull is going to run forever. It's on borrowed time right now, and we need to prepare for a shock that will be like no other that we've experienced since the 1930s.
And I saw an article that if you can grow vegetables in your backyard and you don't need a very big garden, you can save $1,600 a year on your groceries.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, Charles has taken that a step further. Yeah. You know, he's grown things for their nutritional value, and I think one of his backyard crops is breadfruit, which as far as how easy it is to grow and how much of your nutritional needs it can provide, it's a relatively efficient crop. So you may recall from the movie Mutiny on the Bounty that was what the
bounty.
The bounty was sent to bring home.
Yeah.
You know,
or the crew mutinied. Well, not just because the captain was cruel, but because all the ship's water was going to the breadfruit and the crew were basically dying from dehydration.
Right. And the breadfruit itself was going to be like high nutrition, low cost for the slaves working the sugar plantations in the Caribbean. So, it was all economics that drove the breadfruit equation. So I don't know I haven't eaten any breadfruit lately. I'm not even sure what it tastes like, but perhaps this is a good time to start acquiring a taste for breadfruits. And as Charles is always suggesting, you know, getting your reducing your needs, not planning on being able to ramp up your production when it's going to be much more difficult to do. You know, you live within your means is what he's suggesting, and I think this is really a good time to practice that virtue.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me on, Jim. It is always a pleasure.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.